once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, April 22nd, the year of our Lord, 2017.
If you haven't done something with your taxes, you're a little late.
Well, you know, file an extension.
Well, you should have done that. That's what I mean. You're a little late. You should have done it by the 18th.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people don't realize when the tax due date is. It's October 15th. You must have your taxes filed by October 15th.
Unless this year it happens to fall on a Saturday, in which case they move it forward to the next business day, which happened to fall on the
Tuesday,
which was, yes, exactly. Yeah, anyway. So we've got a caller on 773-1400.
You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello, caller. I don't know if you hear us. We hear you.
All right. Could be somebody's there.
Yeah, well, I can hear them in the background, but
it may be that was a pocket dial. I have another name for that in when I'm not on the air.
I don't carry my cell phone in the vicinity of the part of the body that you were about to refer to.
You're reading my mind?
Your
mind just down there? Is that what you're saying?
Sometimes I think my mind is in the lower part of my anatomy, but not today, okay?
All right. Okay.
Once more under the phone, dear friends. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Caller?
Yes. I'd called at the end of the last hour.
Yes.
And I just wanted to follow up on one thing that the gentleman was saying about the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to clarify. It seemed like that what he was suggesting, that the going into the future, the middle class will need to somehow self-evolve into something like Homo innovativus, that the greatest skill set will
sure.
be the ability to change.
That is, you got it.
Okay.
And that is, and I, you know, we have this, as a matter of fact, the article in the Wall Street Journal said something very clear. This is the biggest change, he said, in the history of humanity and in culture, since we stopped being hunter-gatherers and settled down to be, work on the farm. In that, every change that has occurred before, a change occurred slowly enough that you could learn something new as a child and pursue it and be in that field, and as long as you're really good, you learned it from your parents, and you could carry it through your life, but it's just not true anymore.
Now this is a great strength that is often looked at as a weakness in the United States. There's this massive strength that we're trying to medicate out of existence. And I'm going to approach it from this direction. About 80% of the CEOs of the major corporations of the United States have been or could be diagnosed with some form of ADD or ADHD, attention deficit disorder. That also tends to go with innovation. People that are creative, and you'll notice this about people with ADD, whether they be young or old, they have a specific something that they can utilize their attention wholeheartedly on, whether that's a computer game or a business. ADD leads to innovation. It leads to exploration. It leads to the ability to change when things happen. If you think from the other direction, the folks that follow the rules and do what they're told, that's an area, I mean, we do want the rules to be followed, especially the big ones like thou shalt not kill. And even if you have ADD, we're not going to budge on that stuff. But innovation needs a certain amount of rebelliousness to buck the system. And we have been medicating that. We have been telling kids you're bad to have that. We've been complaining because the United States has the highest proportion of ADD of any developed nation, and we say this is a horrible thing. No, it's the very reason why we exist. We know that this is hereditary. We know that there are genetics that lead to this. People with ADD all over the world for generations have been coming here because they can buck the system here and make a better system constantly. When we get so hidebound that we can't change, when we get so rules-based that we say only the people that are here are the ones that get to be successful, instead of being inclusive in success, we're breaking the American dream. The American dream isn't just that I can become successful. It's that we can all become successful. It's the reason why our ancestors came here. So really, the industry that is the future of America is the history of America. How do we innovate? How do we keep changing for the better? Let's not get complacent. Let's not become Europe. Europe grew complacent because they had this habit of long-term careers. We only had that for a very short period of time in the history of the United States. We consider it to be the norm in that our parents worked for the same corporation for their entire life, and so therefore that's the norm of history. No, remember, go west, young man, is a statement that grew from, you can't stay in the same way that I am because there's not room here. You need to innovate. Go somewhere else. You can't have the same, you know, in Europe, you just worked for your dad.
Go ahead.
So there seems to be a very distinct difference between being, I think the term you used was hidebound, and having everyone in the workforce constantly thinking in terms of innovation. It makes sense for there to be innovators in the workforce. So you mentioned the CEOs and their potential ADD.
Right.
But it seems that we're suggesting that there would be no essential quality to the nature of the work that is being performed if we're anticipating that within a very short time, my job is going to change yet again. And so at the bottom, at the middle, and at the top, everybody is in this flux of change all the time. And so who is doing the essential work?
The machines.
And that is the case. When I mentioned the end of last hour, 80% of the workforce in the year 1900 was in agriculture. The tractor came along, and we said, there's no way that all the people that were doing the essential work, there's got to be essential work. And there was, because new industries came up. But nobody knew at the time what those industries would be. But it was new technology.
We've moved beyond the tractor now. And across the Midwest and up into Canada, if you actually go out during harvest time or you go out during the time that plowing and planting is going on, more and more what you're seeing is machines operating in the field with nobody in them. And that's the trend we're seeing there. It's the trend we're going to see across the board. Driverless trucks, driverless cars. Right now, there's pretty steady work in running. It does take a certain amount of innovation and thinking to run a forklift in a warehouse. But
Amazon's not doing it that way.
We're already in a position where the forklifts can be automated. Anything that takes a low level of intellectual acuity.
Even though there are some forklift operators that are artists.
Right. Anything that takes a low level of intellectual acuity, a machine can do. If you're bored at what you're doing, then it probably, within 10 to 20 years, that job won't exist because a machine can do it.
Now, to get directly to your question, what is the industry that the question from last hour and you rephrasing it? What is the industry that's going to take off and build on the people that will become unemployed? Well, first, the unemployment in agriculture took place over probably 5 to 10 years, where the tractor just became huge in a very quick time frame. That's not going to happen right now. So much of our employment is in the service industry. So it's not going to come through and just completely sweep through and remove all the jobs. What we're going to see is a productivity growth and a gradual shift in what people are doing. But that shift is going to be to more, in some ways, chaos, in that you'll be in a place where you're going to have to learn new skills on a regular basis. And if you get ahead of that to think about what skills are out there that you know will be valuable, this is the thing at the time of agriculture, when you brought up the question about CEOs and ADD, and you need to have some innovators, but there's essential work that needs to be done. that essential work was impossible from the folks that were trying to do agriculture until they got trained for it. The innovation is something we are absolutely not educating right now. So we look at it as an impossibility. Some people just aren't good at it. Well, it's like saying a five-year-old trying to play the piano next to somebody who's been training on the piano for 20 years. Well, it's just hopeless. The five-year-old should just give up. We need to look at this and say there's ways to train each skill, including innovation and creativity, that allow it to be intuitive and not at all impossible, the opposite, so that once people start thinking that way, they don't know how to not think that way anymore. And that's going to require a fundamental shift in the way we educate people. It's going to require a fundamental shift in the way that we educate at the workforce as well. But right now, you can get ahead of that and do it for yourself by saying, what is innovating? What does it mean to do that? That's a form of innovation in itself, to build your own curriculum on training yourself to be innovative. But we're all capable of it. Just look at a group of five-year-olds. Every one of them is innovative. We train it out of ourselves. So
I follow your logic about innovation being necessary. And right there toward the end, I think you had really started talking about the nature of education and how we actually educate ourselves and others.
Right.
I guess my question is really more systemic to the entire workforce, is do we really want a workforce where no one is really good at what they do? They're just good getting good at something else.
No. You can be very good at what you do first. Let me give you an example. Let me give you a concrete example, okay? Today, there's a lot of people work in automobile in body shops, right, across the country,
right,
and in wreckers and so on. Well, presuming we go to driverless computer-controlled cars over the next decade, which is an almost certain thing that's going to happen, those people are going to be out of work. Now, what can they do? If I were advising one of them today, I would say, hey, let me tell you what's going to happen. There's going to be a lot of vehicles that aftermarket are going to need installation of self-driving technology. So you're going to have a big boom in this installation of self-driving technology. So start training in that and get good at it and get better than other people. And as this comes along, then you've got a job. But that's going to be temporary, because
all new cars are going to have that built in already.
5 to 10 years down the road from there, you won't have any more cars to retrofit. And then what are you going to do? And that is an example of an evolving job series where people can get really good at what they do, but then they're going to need to be ready to shift to doing something else.
The best innovators are best at what they do as well. So think like Mark Zuckerberg. Mark Zuckerberg is a great programmer. And that's what led him to create Facebook. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, they were excellent at what they did, as well as being great at innovation. I'm not saying that craftsmanship goes away. I'm not saying that people aren't going to be good at what they do anymore. But whatever business you're in, whether it's in a machine shop or whatever, the innovator in the machine shop is the one that knows how to build all the things, the new tools, to make what they're doing better. Now, traditionally, that guy never marketed that product. That's a big boom going on now, is the people that made something to improve their daily existence, they're now able to take that to market. So what we're seeing is this rebirth of small-scale innovation. And that's what I'm talking about. Build on that.
Right. So in terms of human resources, if a person is looking at job applicants, they would be looking for someone who shows evidence of innovative ability, maybe call it a term.
Yeah. And let me give you an example about that. In many cases, and I had a corporate executive say this to me not real long ago, he made an interesting discovery. They were hiring high school graduates, and he made an interesting discovery. He found out that people are people who have liberal arts degrees, bachelor's degrees in liberal arts, could adjust to a changing environment much better than a high school graduate could. So they began to focus on trying to find people and then willing to pay more for people with college degrees. And if you look out there right now, you'll discover that people with a four-year college degree in anything have a much lower unemployment rate. They have higher incomes. Across the board, they are far more valuable. And the reason, and if you look over there to see which group of them as a large group, where you get the best bang for the buck, oddly enough, it's in liberal arts, which doesn't train you to do anything. And just simply says you need to be able to think. You need to be able to think rationally.
Well, that's something we can teach younger. It's something that it's easier to teach younger if we get ahead of unteaching it. Because we're all born as experimenters and innovators. We want to put everything in our mouths. We want to explore every nook and cranny around us. And as we go through the training process to be a cog in the wheel at an industrial manufacturing facility, you're trained to sit at your seat. Don't ask too many questions. Don't collaborate with your friends. So there's a system in place that's designed to keep us from being innovative. If we remove that and allow innovation to be seen as something to be striven for across the board, it doesn't matter which intelligence group, we don't have to be talented and gifted to be trained to be innovative, because everybody is talented and gifted at something.
You know, and again, it comes back to something. You want, the fundamental question is, why do we have an education system like we have an education system? And the reason is because we've had it that way.
Because we had
designed,
this, right, we had this was, problem
right,
before.
It was designed to create industrial minds. But we're
and
entering.
It did a great job. And it's the best in the world.
We're entering a post-industrial age. You know, I've been hiring people for 35 years. And I can tell you the biggest challenge that we have when we hire people today, and it takes about 2.5 years to teach them, to unteach them something that's pounded into their heads beginning in the first grade or even in kindergarten. And the primary lessons we learn in school are, don't ask any questions.
Any answer is better than no answer.
And a wrong answer is better than an I don't know. And don't collaborate with the people around you.
And that's the opposite of everything in the post-industrial area.
Yeah,
we have to collaborate with each other.
We have to ask questions.
We have to not give wrong answers because you don't want to say, I don't know. Think in this business, as an economist, it's not that big a deal because economists are always blathering on about stuff they don't know about and just sounding intelligent. But when we're dealing with actual people's assets, money, we better not be saying something that's not true just because we don't want to say, I don't know.
And it takes 2.5 years, typically, after they're employed by us, that we could trust a person to say, I don't know. We can trust that the person, if they don't know, will ask questions. When I tell them to do something and they don't understand, they don't ask questions. They just take what they don't understand and pass on their lack of understanding to another person.
And this is what we train in school.
And in school, you're taught under no circumstances should you talk to your neighbors. Under no circumstances, if you have a test or a problem in front of them, should you get help from anybody else. And we spend, if a high school graduate, or we spend 12 years training them to work on an assembly line and not talk to anybody, not ask any questions, and do precisely what they're told to do, no matter how stupid it seems to them.
Now, I just mentioned ADD. I'm going to come back and say, be average students. Average Bs, not average As. Be average students are the vast, vast majority of entrepreneurs and business owners in the United States.
I started to say, you talking about me?
Yeah, and what that means is that they weren't good at following the rules of the system. The thing that was designed to train them to be a good cog, they couldn't wrap their mind around. So they are smart, So even though they couldn't wrap their mind around it, they still got B's and C's. But they're the bosses now of most of these businesses, and the A students are the ones that are either doing research or they're a cog in the wheel. They are doing what they're told to do, and that's, you know, think about that if you're a parent. Think about that as you send your child to school. I thought about it enough that we're founding a Montessori school, and that there's a great deal of innovation that's taking place in the school system directly because of this. Austin is looking at an experiment of taking its elementary schools to Montessori, all of them. And that's just a different, much more customized to each student learning path rather than a generalized, everyone sit down and listen to the same lesson at the same time. That's the cog in the wheel. And yes, we all need to hit all the major areas in our education so that we can function in the world. But we don't have to be taught it the same way, because all of us learn differently. And we learn differently depending on what we're interested in at the moment. And as long as we're careful about giving that out, innovation grows out of that. The big thing about college, liberal arts and thinking, that causes innovation and causes people to be better at being hired post-industrially is that you have to take an active part in what you're learning in college. You have to say, this is my schedule and I'm choosing it. Not just choosing your electives. You're choosing your entire lineup of what you're going to learn. Some things are mandatory, but you get to choose the path.
Ah, guided pathway.
Right. So if you're choosing the path, that leads to innovation. Even in a structured environment like that, it leads to innovation.
And unfortunately, an awful lot of higher education is going the other way right now. I don't know if you know that or not. Instead of a college education educating a person, now they're far more often today training a person. You know, like
you raised that question earlier. I mean, that comment, that issue earlier, and it seems that if the industry is in communication with the educational delivery system, that what's coming out of the educational delivery system should be meeting the demands of the industry.
Yeah, but that's not what you want.
Whatever the industry is.
Yeah, the industry wants people that are trained. But our economy needs people that are educated. And
are you saying in addition to the ones that are trained or to replace the ones that are trained?
Yes, both of those.
You need all of that. Like, for instance, if right now you go to University of Phoenix, whatever, and you learn to be a very efficient technician on a series of equipment that is used in hospitals today, right?
Right.
Do you really think that same equipment's going to be there in 10 years?
So
the important thing, yes, we need to know, a person needs to know how to use that equipment. But when a bachelor's degree, which is often what they're being given now, for instance, a bachelor's degree basically produces a person who is a trained, mechanical-minded person, rather than teaching that person how to be educated. The purpose of the bachelor's degree used to be to learn how to learn. Today, far more often, particularly in the private schools, it's not that people are not taught how to learn. They're not learning. They're trained to do something specific, and unfortunately, that something specific they're trained how to do won't be there in 10 years.
Now, throwing this in, this isn't the first time this has happened either. In fact, you go all the way back to the meaning of the word doctor. It means doctrine. So even the greatest educational degree that we have out there is about learning a doctrine. And we expect somewhere between bachelor and doctor is the most innovation, because it's pretty rare, if you're not in pure research, to see economical innovation taking place by a PhD. Now, they can do research, but they're doing it for research, and somebody else comes along and says, hey, that's valuable. So you can over-educate and lose innovation, just like you can under-educate and lose education. It's one of these, innovation has to be specifically brought in. It can't just be expected to be a talent. It's like saying the only people that should be musicians are people that just suddenly know how to play music. That's not the way the world works. The greatest musicians of our time grew up holding their instrument. Now, they didn't, in a lot of cases, take great deals of formalized training in it, but they weren't an overnight genius of suddenly they knew how to do it. Even the children that can play at a very young age, if you look at Mozart, for instance, or any number of the child prodigies of today on the piano, Mozart as a child was a prodigy. And people go, wow, how did he just must have grown up knowing how to play the piano. Well, his family was all prodigies on the piano because both of his parents were expert level professional musicians. And they trained their kids. And Mozart was the best of the kids at piano and went on from there. So this concept of some people are just more talented, it has to do with how we train them to follow their interests. We all have that talent somewhere.
If I can say one thing, I'm going to have to go, but I really enjoyed this. If the innovators, I can agree with you guys to a point that there needs to be constant innovation. I think the Japanese at one point called it Kaizen, continual improvement. And there's a demand for constantly reevaluating what we're doing and how we're doing it. Can we do it better?
Actually,
especially in America, quicker, faster.
The Japanese learned it from us, though.
Right. Yeah, I was just throwing their term out there. But the idea that even the people you mentioned, research, someone goes out and comes up with a new idea, I wonder if this will work. You need to be able to go to people who are trained in research, who are going to think of the scientific model. They're going to do it, the scientific method, the same way. They're going to follow that method. And it seems like there may be some things that we don't want innovation in. We want to be able to depend on that to always be there.
Oh, yeah.
To be consistent.
Yeah, there are certain – but those are not trainings. Those are disciplines. Those are different. You can train somebody to do something, but a discipline is a different thing altogether.
Right. Being able to stick to a task and stay at it is something that needs training.
You know, the scientific method is a discipline, and it's followed very poorly now, by the way.
I've got a subject on this. Thank you for the call, caller. We really appreciate it.
I want to throw something else in there. I have a master's degree and a master's of science degree. And of my class that graduated with that master's degree, there were about 20 people in the class. I was the only one that chose to write a thesis. The rest of them did what's called a capstone program, and I didn't even know such things existed. Normally, a master's in science requires a thesis to be written. A thesis is a hard, hard, hard thing to do. And the reason it's a hard thing to do, it requires somebody to choose a subject, do research, and then logically be able to prove the conclusion based on the research, and the research can't be guesses. It has to be solid something based on a discipline, and state it logically in a very disciplined fashion. Whereas a capstone, which is now the standard in getting a master's degree, simply says, can you practically do something? In other words, can you basically take all these classes that you were in and all these textbooks that you read and pile them all together and do it practically? Can you, in other words, it's basically training in a job as opposed to being forced to think rationally and come up with an original idea. And that's one of the areas where I think education inflation is going on, is that we get a lot of people who are simply really, really good at regurgitating something that they didn't believe when they first read, didn't know why it was, but it was the authority, so there it is, and here is my regurgitation of it, therefore I'm a master
in that area, but when it comes to having original thoughts, I have learned that that's a really bad idea.
All right. Now I have something that is very much related to this, about innovation and about pure research and about collaboration. So there's a solar-powered device that's just been announced. It's a solar-powered device that can convert 3 liters of water every day per kilogram of material inside the device on the sun, just basically taking it out of the air. And it's an innovation that took place. There was a chemist at the University of California in Berkeley who came up with a material that is really good when energized at drawing water out of the air. So he took it to a researcher at MIT and said, we should build something with this. This is a real problem. I kind of stumbled on this in my chemistry research, and this looks like a solution to an existing problem. So the device was created at MIT in conjunction with, and this was the engineering folks at MIT. So the name of the chemist is Omar Yagi. He was born in Jordan, and he's an American citizen now, but his immigration had a lot to do with the H-1B, the visa that's being limited right now. So he came up with this thing. He's one of the innovative minds that we're proud of. We're proud to call him an American. This is why all of our ancestors came here to innovate. So then he went to Evelyn Wang at MIT, who's in their mechanical engineering department as an associate professor. And she wasn't born here either, but she's an American citizen and she's innovating. Alexander Graham Bell was not born an American. You can go down the list of our great innovators throughout our history. Tesla, you just start down the list, and you're going to find that a great deal of our innovation comes because we are a melting pot, that we bring the greatest minds here. It isn't a protect our land against people coming to steal our jobs. It's a there's enough for everybody, and we can make it better by continuing to improve. So that's kind of the wrap-up of this conversation. We're having to fall back on people that were educated elsewhere for some of our innovation, which means our system of education needs to be thoroughly reviewed. And that's an area that we talk about logistics, and we spent some time on that earlier last hour talking about logistics and how logistics is important for the economy. Education is even more so. And unfortunately, it's an area that we are becoming hidebound. We are looking at it and saying, this is just what we do. Because if we change it, it's going to be disruptive. And it will be. That's one of the difficulties with getting tax reform done or getting a change to any major portion of our system, is that it's going to be disruptive and it's going to be painful to some people. But if we don't do it, it takes a massive shock to the system, a really negative event to cause us to do it drastically, and more people are hurt that way. And that's a really good example of how productivity rises in drastic recessions because there's these big layoffs and people that go, I don't want to get laid off, so they figure better ways of doing what they're doing. If we can get ahead of that and be innovative, then we don't have to wait to the big negative thing. We don't have to wait for Social Security to fail. If we get ahead of it and fix it first, we don't have to wait for productivity to drop to have problems. If we get ahead of that productivity drop, we don't have to wait for our revenue to drop horribly in the tax system on the corporate side to innovate there. It's everywhere we look, every aspect, whether you're at work and you're looking around and say, how do we do this better? This is the same problem I had yesterday and the day before and the day before. How do we fix it? That's the kind of question that needs to be asked across the board, and what I think the confidence signals that we were measuring after the Trump election were saying, finally, we're going to get that. And there's a little bit of a disappointment now that we're not seeing it at the rate that we wanted to.
You know,
what you're referring to there, I think that's critical, is we're missing something, and there's been a lot of attempts at it, and I don't know if we're going to get it. We're not going to get it the way we just with the last election, and that is immigration reform, where we allow more people into the United States. The Trump administration has moved to cut immigration into the United States, even by highly qualified people. And I understand that reaction of jobs are being taken from people in the United States. But
right.
Like you mentioned, we in New England, factories are not opening. Tax revenues are not accruing to the people who are there because they don't have enough people to fill the jobs. And
that's happening more and
right.
more across the country.
And we are going to be, frankly, in deep economic trouble unless we can renew our ability to allow good people into the country. And
yeah,
I really
emphasize good people into the country.
And it's the point, and then there's a big issue here. One of the things that seems to be very contrary to the populist rhetoric right now, every study has shown that immigrants to the United States have a very, very, very much lower crime rate than people who were born here.
Yeah. Particularly lower economic group people, which many of the immigrants
yeah.
are.
And
their crime rate is much lower than people in the same socioeconomic group.
And the mere fact that somebody is willing to uproot themselves somewhere else and come here, which is what our ancestors did, says that they are innovative people who are willing to take a risk and go to a different culture and a different economy.
Willing to sacrifice a lot to be here.
And I know that there is an intrinsic, they're different, they speak a different language, they're going to mess with our culture, they're going, and believe me, I felt that.
We all feel that. There's no way you can't. That's deep in our genetics.
There's really a fairly simple solution to our major governmental economic issues right now. Social Security, Medicare, the whole thing. And that is to allow more immigration. And if we insist that we won't allow more legal immigration, then we, by definition, will see illegal immigration.
Unless we make it so difficult to do business here that
then,
we lose that as well.
Right.
And that is how we stop immigration, by the way, by becoming less good. People want to come here for a reason. What is the reason they want to come here? Well, because we have a great system. The way to stop them from coming is to not have a great system. And if we put enough restrictions on travel, if we put enough restrictions on how to make money, we won't have an illegal immigration problem anymore. But we'll have bigger problems.
By the way, there's an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal that I welcome you to read, and that is that not a single representative in the Senate or the House of Representatives who represents people on the border with Mexico is supporting a wall. Not a single one, including both our senators, all of the Congress people who actually represent the border districts in Texas, not one of them is supporting putting the wall up.
That's very telling. It's the people that are far away from the border that are afraid of it. And yes, there are issues at the border. Don't get us wrong. There needs to be enforcement. There needs to be crime prevention. There needs to be checks and balances against illegal immigration. Don't get us wrong there. But what we can say without a doubt is our immigration system needs reformed. And it used to be people said, yes, immigration needs to be reformed and we're going to do it in a good way. But first, we have to stop the leaking. First, we have to stop the problem. That doesn't work. If all your work is taken up with bailing the boat, you never fix the boat.
Yeah.
And the wall is not a fix. It's putting duct tape on one of the holes. Most illegal immigration, this is something that is extremely well documented, does not take place on the border, on the land. It takes place in the airports, the people that come on valid visas and then overstay. That is the vast majority of illegal immigration.
And one of the reasons that's true, and by the way, if you see a video of people streaming across the border and through ranch lands in South Texas, The vast majority of that is from many, many years ago. As we have allowed, the North American Free Trade Agreement has been the primary restriction on illegal immigration.
Yeah, because they can do business right with us there without coming here.
The more factories that get set up in northern Mexico, the fewer people immigrate from south of the border to north of the border to get a job. And I know we don't like that, but again, tie that in with the thing that Jake was talking about a minute ago, that we have sections of the country where there simply are no more – the factories can't be opened. They can't be expanded because there's nobody to work there. And we're down to the unemployment – the official unemployment rate even in Texas is 5% right now, which is about as low as we can go. And we do need some change. Unfortunately, I don't see that change coming out of Washington right now. I'd love to see somebody go in there who would be willing to make that kind of change, that kind of innovation, to set up two things. And factually, let me give you an example.
It's 4.2%, not 5%.
No, it just came out. The state one just was just
Texas
published.
Is 4.2% as of
really?
April 2000.
Okay.
Oh, this is several years ago.
No. I saw it came out. Actually, our unemployment rate has gone up a little bit in Texas, not much, but because a lot of people are moving to Texas. But the point is that, and for instance, let me diverge here a little bit. In New England, Hawaii, and a number of other places, the unemployment rate is now like the 2.8%. It's in the 2 to 3% range, and at the 2 to 3% range, everybody's working. I mean, everybody is working that wants to work. And once you get down in that range, two point something percent of people are
changing.
That's
just people
moving
going
between
from
jobs.
One job to another.
So we have a problem. And there's a really good solution to the problem, and the really good solution to the problem is to allow more people into the United States, but we have a Congress that won't allow more people in the United States because their constituents object to it. Now, that's a real problem, and this is one of those districts where people object to more people coming into the United States to pay taxes.
And again, don't get us wrong, we recognize the emotional issue. We don't want people coming in and taking our jobs. That's not the threat at the moment. And it's not really been a threat for a very, very long time, unless you're in the area of wanting to go out and pick peaches. Now, used to be a high school pastime. You know, you get a job to go pick peaches. Well, that still exists to some extent, but there's a lot more machines doing now. And before that, it was illegal immigrants doing.
Well, what's actually happened since we've cut down on – since illegal immigration has fallen off dramatically is more and more of the vegetables and fruits that were picked in the United States are now being grown someplace else.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, you can see that across Florida and you can see it in California. So what happens is the place where they used to grow fruits or vegetables is now being converted into suburbia.
Right.
And the fruits and vegetables are grown in another country.
Because illegal immigration stopped.
And the point is that when we have jobs and a need for labor in the United States, and it's I'm not objecting to people to us importing fruits or vegetables. What I am saying is if the people that are picking the fruits and vegetables are working in other countries, they're not paying Social Security taxes, they're not paying income taxes in the United States.
Right, and no amount of border adjustment is going to make up for that. No amount of tax at the border is going to make up for producing it here and having all the aspects of that raw labor and innovation and production here. Our tax revenue is based on here.
Well, I don't. One of the things that actually bothered me a little bit about the border adjustment tax is that the huge amount of money that would be generated from that was not going to go to shore up Social Security.
No.
Or reduce the deficit.
No.
It was going to go to cut taxes in the upper income tax brackets.
And by the way, just so that you're all aware of this, we think it'd be great to lower taxes and raise spending. except that long term, there's a lot of problems with that.
We have to borrow the money.
Yeah, we would have to borrow the money. Now, I think it may be worthwhile to do for a short period of time to really crank up the economy and get it back into a track. Right now, it's in that slow groove.
I'm going to disagree with you on that point, because if we pump more money into the economy, the objective will be to hire more people.
I would consider it pumping money into the economy. I would consider it not pumping money out of the economy.
Okay, but again, let's just say that corporations have more money right now. What are they going to do with it?
Well, I'm not even there's a lot they could do with it.
Now, there's a lot they could do.
Now,
with it,
a lot of
not
it would be
a lot of people.
Increasing automation.
Right.
So it would be new innovations, but all of that would increase the speed that we're moving to automation, because it would mean they wanted to do more work here and there's not enough people to do it here, but they get a better incentive to do it here. So they're going to do it here anyway, and automation's going to take off.
So this is the Federal Reserve is now withdrawing their stimulus and talking about that either late this year, beginning next year, they're going to start shrinking their balance sheet, which means they're going to be sucking money out of the economy because we have too much money in the economy.
Right, because enough people are now employed. Everybody's got money coming in as they have money coming in.
So at this moment in time, trying to stimulate the economy would be – the Federal Reserve will be trying to destimulate the economy while the federal government is trying to stimulate the economy, because otherwise
right.
we wind up with too much money.
What I see as a potential here is if we fix the tax system, we lower the taxes, we deregulate quite a lot, you're going to see more innovation. You're also going to see inflation start up higher, because more money is going to be in the system. More people are going to be able to be paid to do exactly the same thing that they were already doing, but with more money, which is what leads long term to inflation, because then they can afford a higher price for the same item they would have paid a lower price for.
So then interest rates go up.
Right.
And that causes the federal debt, which is pretty big,
to become very expensive. This is
ridiculously
right.
expensive. So
the pain that we see right there, though, is breaking us out of that entire – we're getting this habit, this groove that we're getting into, is very much like Japan. If we don't get back into thinking like younger people – and how we build and how we innovate, then we will be like Japan or like Europe. We have to take some pain and look around and say, all right, if interest rates go up, and they are going to go up, the cost of the debt is going to go up, we're going to have to look at the problems that we already know are problems. But this will be the reason to do it.
The issue is to get innovation started again. You made the argument a moment ago very eloquently. Most of our great innovation
it's from immigration.
Come from immigration. And when we restrict immigration, we restrict innovation.
Yeah, and if you look at Europe, and I know a lot of people say the immigration rate in Europe is really high. No, it isn't. Not compared to the United States. They talk about the Islamic wave entering France. That's just because they're concentrating in localized areas, not because as a percentage of the population they have anywhere near the immigration that the United States does. They are not allowing immigration. They are taxing businesses because their population's getting older. And as the older people are not productive anymore, they want someone else to pay for their entitlements, which stifles immigration. And the word slippery slope is a good term here. It isn't that we have to do any more actions in the future. We're already starting the slide. Unless we take a moment and really innovate our system. We have a system that's capable of innovation. We have a political system that refreshes itself every 2 years, and long-term every 6 years. If we are concentrated on really looking at tax reform and really looking at lower regulations and better business practices, then we need to start by looking at our own political system and why we believe wholeheartedly in any given party. The non-party folks are now outnumbering any individual party. The people that are not Democrat and not Republican outnumber each of those parties individually. And we're about out of time. We got to play real quick commercials here,
right,
too. So
some real quick commercials.
Right.
Play them quickly.
All right, do it.
All right, we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. So to close out the hour, we have had a grand time talking about lots of big, major socioeconomic issues. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal where today, Real-Time Economics, Tyler Cowen talks about the fact that Americans are too complacent. Worth reading. I'd recommend it to you. You can read a couple of articles in Wall Street Journal every week or every day or whatever without paying anything. I'd recommend you read that. And we'll be back next week with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we are investor management folks who do that type of thing. And the telephone number is 254-947-1111. Or
you can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Read our articles. Listen to our podcasts. Look at our ugly mugs and our beautiful staff. If you'd like to email us directly, it's jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
True. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.